The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2023. This is with Black Pilled. I should say that Black Pilled is a hotly anticipated guest each year, and he has been on every year since 2018. So, Black Pilled, Devin Stack, welcome back to Millennial.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I've been watching your stream. I was saying to you before we went on air, while I've been working on Millennial over the last 3 months, I've listened to God knows how many of your streams because they serve as an excellent accompaniment while one is working. So thank you for that. And it is an interesting niche that you've carved out. I used to watch you on YouTube back in the day, but you seem to largely... You were never banned from YouTube, as far as I remember. You sort of just turned away from it in disgust.
Yeah, well, it was a mixture of that, and they didn't demonetize the channel entirely, but they would demonetize every video within like 5 minutes of me posting it. So it was kind of like, well, what's the point? And then everyone else that was cool was getting kicked off, and I was like, well, why am I even here? You know, this is stupid. And I was already kind of trying to be careful about how I would phrase things, and being mindful of the TOS and all that. And it was so I was being careful for no reason. And so I just decided, and especially because around that time that all that was going on, I was kind of discovering more things myself that I wanted to convey to others that were a little outside the TOS. And so I was like, why am I even here? And so I went to, I think initially DLive, and then DLive kicked a bunch of people off. And so a lot of people went to Trovo. So I said, all right, I'll go to Trovo. And then same thing happened at Trovo. And then Odyssey finally came up, which was a godsend. The future, I guess, of Odyssey is uncertain. But if it remains the way that it has been, it's really, it's so good that the SPLC did a piece about it featuring me. Not that long ago, talking about how bad Odyssey was because it was allowing people to make basically minimum wage doing content, and which is all donated, by the way. It's not even, there's no advertisers on Odyssey. So they were upset that people were paying for something that they wanted. And, anyway, so hopefully that stays around. If not, I'm simulcasting now on Rumble. Just to honestly, in anticipation of the possibility that someone on Odyssey or someone whoever, because I guess it went up on the auction block and no one even knows who bought it, or at least not to my knowledge. And so if someone that's shitty bought it, then we'll have a place to go, at least temporarily. I don't know how long I would survive on Rumble. I'm actually a little surprised that I'm still there now. I have taken down one or two of my streams on the replays on Rumble, just because I've heard that they get a little they don't like it when you discuss historic events. Let me put it that way, and possibly the details being inflated. And so I did a couple streams talking about Holocaust survivors and some of their stories, and diamonds being shit out and stuff like that, and just things that seemed a little unrealistic. I did one featuring David Cole, who, was that Jewish revisionist in the 80s and 90s, who has since recanted and become like a MAGA, Republican, I guess, or just a regular Republican.
Has he actually recanted? Has he recanted this Holocaust revisionism? I didn't.
Yeah. Know that. Yeah, so it's funny, even in Wikipedia, if you look him up, they say that he gave a disingenuous recantation. And I think it's because, if you remember, the JDL was physically attacking him. The Jewish Defense League, for those who don't know, it was like a militant ADL. It was almost like the ADL meets Antifa kind of a thing. And they were assaulting him, you know, and attacking him in public. And so he changed his name, went underground, and first he did his recantation, and then reinserted himself into Republican politics at some point, I guess, and then was doxxed. And now he acts like that almost didn't, that none of that happened. But it doesn't change the research. It doesn't, you know, none of the facts of what he covered have changed. So I still think it's relevant, the work that he did. And been able to refute it. I think in his recantation, and I haven't, to be honest, I actually haven't read it, but I've heard that what he focused, he basically, from what I was, my understanding is he basically said, well, sure, there's no proof in the camps that I investigated, but it happened in all these other camps I didn't go to, you know, and so I don't know exactly
right. Okay. You
know, how he squares that.
Interesting. I didn't know that. I know that he was writing at Tacky Mag. I hope I'm not getting mixed up with somebody else. I'm sure it was him. A weird convergence there, because Theodore Dalrymple wrote there, Gavin McInnes wrote there, and then I think it also had David Cole, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, that doesn't really matter. On the matter of online censorship, Rumble, several people said to me that I should be streaming Millennial this year to Rumble, and I think they were probably correct. To be honest, it came up at the end there, right before I was going to begin this, and I thought I just couldn't be fucking bothered, because by that time I'd been working flat out for 3 months on this, and I just didn't want to do another. I didn't want to start another unknown quantity at that point, and I thought I'll just do it without. I'll use Twitter and Telegram. It's the first time I'm streaming to Telegram and Twitter and Odyssey, and just be content with that. And if next year we have to switch to Rumble, it's just too bad. I'm willing to take that that hit rather than starting it now, because when you start with a new platform, you just don't know. And the other thing is, I don't have moderators for all these different platforms. And I do want moderators, because, you know, you get people just shitting up the chat and ruining it for everyone else. So I tend to want moderation. And it's just a matter of pragmatism, really. But I do think probably Rumble will become relevant. I don't know. It might surprise, but I believe that BitChute is going to have live streaming next year.
That would be, I mean, they've been promising that for years. So if they were to actually have reliable streaming, that'd be awesome. Because I believe in those guys in terms of their ideology in keeping it, you know, as free speech as legally possible. The hang up with that, though, of course, is, I mean, they're out of the UK, right? So they're under the boot of laws out there. Rumble, though, is out of Canada. So you're going to have similar problems, I think, down the road. So,
oh, definitely. I mean, they're Canada, fucking hell. Where would you even begin? Australia comes in for a lot of stick with COVID, but Canada was just as bad. And Canada is also, it's all with the Holocaust denial stuff, the hate speech stuff, and even, did it come up on Millennial last year, or was it someone who told me this privately? Apparently they're talking about banning. Yeah, it was on Millennial last night. They're going to ban denial of what were they called? The residential schools. You know, these. I find this absolutely ridiculous. The idea that these these nuns were killing children by the dozen and then burying them in mass graves. It's like something from a crappy Hollywood horror film.
when all the forensic evidence that they don't talk about, it points to these mass graves not existing. So, I mean, because that was the big thing, right? They were like, oh, we finally found these mass graves. And they went and checked it again. And it was tree roots. Like with their whatever radar.
Their satellite imaging or whatever it was. And it was actually tree roots. I remember that was about 6 months ago. As far as I know, there is literally zero evidence for this.
Right.
It's not like other historical events where you can say, well, maybe there's room for doubt. Here, this is just, it's an effort of will to believe this at all. It's like a decision that someone makes. Yeah, I am going to believe this. There is no evidence for it, but I'm going to believe it anyway. You would need to make that conscious decision. And of course, the big motive for making that decision would be, I'm going to fucking lose my job if I don't believe it.
Right. Well, and it doesn't even make any sense. It just seems like if you're going to do that, well, first of all, what's the motivation for the nuns of the time to do that? And if they were going to do that, why even bother with the school? Just, march them straight into the mass grave or whatever, you know, like if it's an extermination camp, what's the point of having, why even have this costly boarding school associated with it? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. None of it makes any sense. It's just the subtle, well, not so subtle, I guess, in this case, but the subtle demonizing of white people throughout the West. You know, just like I covered two streams ago, I think, that movie that Michelle Obama and Barack Obama produced on Netflix, and it's just like these constant little jabs at white people all throughout the entire thing. And that's just becoming normal. You know, that's just becoming normal.
See, it's scary how far this could go, because this thing with the residential schools, I've remembered it was Endeavor last night who was talking about this. If you want to see that, you should watch that stream. This thing with the residential schools has been accepted. It's been sort of taken on board very easily by people, and that in itself is worrying. Like, I mean, white people have accepted this as truth very easily. It's worrying because it shows that white people are in this position of assuming that they are guilty and that their kind is bad and that their ancestors were evil. So they don't even require evidence anymore. They just take it. They believe it. I mean, that... It, you know, how the fuck is this that we heard umpteen times growing up? I think you and I are about the same age. So many times we heard that, you know, the path to genocide starts with demonizing the group and demonizing its history and discrediting its identity and blaming it for all sorts of things and setting other groups against it. Well. I mean, this is exactly what's now happening with us.
Yeah, no, in fact, I did a stream talking about this. There's this thing going around. It's probably about a year or so ago, but there's the 10 stages of genocide. And if you look at it, this is the official understanding of how genocide unfolds. And it's scary. You know, like the first step is classification. And I just pulled this up randomly on some site here, but it says groups in a position of power will categorize people according to ethnicity, race, religion, or nationality, employing an us versus them mentality. Well, okay. I mean, just the other day, there was the Chicago holiday party where whites aren't allowed to go. All right. So we're already past that, obviously. Phase two is symbolization. People are identified as, whatever that group is, and made to stand out from others with certain colors or symbolic articles of clothing. Okay, well, that's not quite happened yet. I think they're just using that as an example because of the Jewish stars or whatever like that. But you could also say that is happening. It's just that we're beyond, you know, our interactions are mostly digital now. Discrimination. A dominant group uses laws, customs, and political power to deny rights to other groups. I mean, affirmative action, that was like 40 years ago. Dehumanization. Diminish the value of the discriminated group. It's communicated through propaganda. I mean, okay, you know, blacks built America. You know, whites are evil. We're already past that. Organization. A state and its army or militia is designed genocidal killing plans. I mean, that's a little over the top, but you know, we'll see. Polarization, propaganda employed to amplify the differences between the groups Interactions between the groups are prohibited. Well, we just talked about the Chicago thing. The moderate members of the group in the powers are killed. Okay, we haven't gotten there yet. Preparation, the victims are identified, separated, forced to wear the symbols. Of course, they're talking about the Jew stuff. Deportations, isolation, forced starvation. Persecution is stage eight. Victims are identified, isolated, blah, blah, blah. Death lists are drawn up. Phase nine is extermination. And then phase 10 is denial. Of course, they had to do that because of people denying the Holocaust and whatnot. So, yeah, I think that, you know, we're about halfway through that list. And I think that to address what you said earlier about white people believing that their ancestors are evil, I mean, of course they do. I mean, what look at how easily they took to believing the Holocaust narrative and going from a group of people that was very proud, you know, whether you're talking about the English or the Americans, about, you know, defeating the Nazis in World War II, to feeling like that even if this Holocaust narrative was 100% true, let's just say it was for a second, then wouldn't we be the heroes? Wouldn't we be the people that the Jews should be building statues of, you know, and like making memorials to and stuff like that? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. But I just think there's something inherent in us where we're just embarrassed by our success. We're embarrassed by the centuries of dominance that we've had over the rest of the world. And there is this, I think this incongruence between what happened with that, with the reality of that, that dominance over the rest of the world, and this propaganda that's been shoved down the throats of Americans since World War II, that we're all the same. And that, you know, I've covered a bunch in streams of, you know, propaganda films, for example, that were produced by the United States government in preparation for taking in a bunch of Jews coming in from Europe post-World War II. And these films are, you know, they're basically the beginnings of the kinds of propaganda that the boomers would then be subjected to in the 50s and 60s. But it basically it's the same message. It's that, oh, we're all the same just because we, you know, look a little different or whatever, race is skin deep. But, you know, it's a lot of that stuff, you know. And after half a century, or actually coming up on more than that, of hearing this, it's hard to square the reality that whites were so dominant in the world prior to, well, now, I guess, it's slipping away, and the fact that everyone's the same. So it's kind of like on a global level, you're having to make that work out in your head. Like, well, the only way we could have been so dominant, right, is if we were evil, enslaving, you know, people, denying everyone else of the opportunity to become, you know, the as successful as we were. We were always stealing opportunities from people and just brutalizing them and keeping them down. And I think that you see the same kind of problem, or when you talk about or talk to black people, because we can't be honest about race and IQ, they're faced with this. Well, okay, well, if we're exactly the same, why is it that you guys are so much more successful than we are in this society? You know, how come we keep struggling? It's been 400 years and we're still struggling to even just be operating on par with the white majority. And so, because you can't be honest with why that is, you have to come up with some weird mental gymnastics, some weird conspiracy theory. Well, it must, you know, because look, if that was the case, right? If we were all the same and we all had the same capabilities and the same, you know, behaviors and instincts and whatnot, then you would have to come up with some reason why they weren't successful. Like, because there would have to be some outside force that was being applied that was causing them to fail at a higher rate than whites, and so that's the problem. Is it really comes down to the fact that whites are living a lie. They're living an almost an inverse of. I mean, last night I did a stream, and in my research, just randomly, I don't do it with the stream. I came across there was a scientific racist, eugenicist, in the early 1900s in America by the name of Madison Grant. And he was a zoologist and he was a conservationist and he was, you know, like this upper class kind of guy that would, you know, go on safaris and whatnot. And he came across pygmies. He came across this pygmy tribe and he ended up bringing home to New York a 4 foot tall pygmy who had sharpened his teeth because that was kind of like the custom of, I guess, that tribe. So he looked like a monster when he'd open up his mouth. And put him in the zoo. He was in the Bronx Zoo in an exhibit. It's weird to think that in about, you know, 110 years, we went from an environment in the United States where white people were, you know, ruling class WASPs, I guess you could say, were traveling the world and encountering all these other people and seeing them as so different and so not just foreign, but like almost like a subspecies of, as this guy did, and to the extent where he's putting this pygmy guy in a zoo, you know, and to go from that to where we are today, where that pygmy guy would now probably get the job, regardless of his qualifications over you, simply because, to make up for, you know, past injustices or whatever, and the systematic, the system of white supremacy that apparently that we've been ruling the world with.
You know, it's funny you mentioned this thing about that if you assert that we're all equal, then how the hell you're left with this problem of how to explain disparities in outcomes. It's funny you mentioned that because just, I think it was last night, I saw one of the Krasenstein brothers on Twitter saying this. He put up, like, I think it was educational attainment scores, and he said, well, how do you explain that? If there's no racism, then how do you explain this?
Right.
How do you explain these different results? These groups are, one of these groups is doing really badly. You can't possibly say it's because they're less able. So therefore, the only answer is that it's racism. It's white people holding them down.
But that's the thing, though, is it would be if that was the case, or, you know, something else would be happening. It would have to be some kind of foreign interference, right? And so that's why it's so important that we get white people to just stop being pussies and just say, yeah, guess what? Sorry. I mean, I don't make the rules. You know, I'm not the one that made you born with these genetics and me born with these genetics, but let's just be serious here for a second. You know, let's stop beating around the bush.
Yeah.
And just realize, look, we have different capabilities as groups. You know, of course there's always individuals and some individuals are going to, of any group are going to be outliers in either direction and whatever, but let's just be serious here. If we're looking at groups, then, we have to be honest about the attributes of those groups, and that's the thing is the until white and that which is why I think they spent so many decades and so much money convincing white people that race was skin deep. You know, even though like there's, you know, an infinite amount of scientific data to the contrary, the average person is convinced that it's just an aesthetic thing. That's really the only difference is that. Well, we just look different, you know, don't judge a book by its cover, which is also stupid, by the way, because that's why they have a cover, you know?
The point? Exactly.
that's like saying, don't judge a movie by the trailer. It's like, come on, you know, like, but they've been brainwashed with all these stupid little quips and bumper stickers and whatever, and they've never been allowed to hear any other side. And which is why I feel like it's so important to do what I do, because I can't tell you how many people message me or DM me or email me or whatever and say like, oh, I never thought of this before. And it's because, well, how could they in an environment like this, you know, where they're raised to believe that. And I did too. I remember thinking that even though my lived experience, if you will, was telling me the opposite, I remember thinking like, well, you know, maybe it's because of fatherlessness, you know, the Thomas Sowell type stuff. Maybe it's because, the lack of fathers or the 90s conservatism that would say stuff like, well, it's because of welfare, you know, if you know, we if we would just stop giving them welfare, then they would get off their asses and get jobs and become scientists and stuff. And I remember kind of thinking like, okay, well, let's at least give me an explanation, because there is a big disconnect here between what you're telling me about, you know, race only being skin deep, and then all of my personal encounters with other races. And I went to very diverse schools. I went to elementary school in California, and it was, I mean, I'd say the class was probably about 45% white or something like that. Lots of Asian kids, lots of, you know, black kids, lots of Hispanic kids. And I'll tell you, like, it was like a prison yard at recess. People would separate by race, but we're kids. We weren't consciously thinking about it. It's just that we had different proclivities. We had different interests. We had different senses of humor, different values, really. And so we gravitated towards the people that were most like us. And it just, you know, there's exceptions in those situations too, but like, by and large, it separated by race. And, you know, which is why it happens in prisons too. You know, if you go to a prison, it's very racially segregated. They don't, you know, the prison's not doing that. You know, the people are doing that. They're gravitating towards the people most like them, because you're going to have similar goals, similar strategies, similar, you know, upbringings, values, worldviews. And while some of that might be software, a lot of it's hardware. A lot of it's hardware. And until white people in the West can, like I said, I don't know how you go, like the white pill is possibly, it's possible for the inverse to happen too. But it's crazy to me that we went from, like I said, Madison Grant having a pygmy at the zoo in New York, where people, and people finding this socially acceptable too. Like, there were no riots at the, oh my God, he put a pygmy in the zoo. You know, they weren't picketing up. No, people were paying tickets to go see the pygmy at the zoo, you know? And to go from that to where we are today is, that's like an insane change. Now, look, I wouldn't have put the guy in the zoo. Like, I'm not advocating putting people or human beings in zoos. I'm just, you know, using that as so you can see the huge difference.
Yeah, I was going to say, just for clarity, neither of us is here lamenting
right.
that we can't put colored people into zoos, right? That's not the point that's being made here, just for clarity.
Right. No, I think it was fucked up. But I mean, it's funny now, like in retrospect, but but it was fucked up. You should have, I mean, should have left them there. You take a photo or something like that. But yeah, it still just shows you, it illustrates how different, because this was a member of the ruling class, this guy. So to go from a ruling class that's what they're doing, that's how they're interacting with diversity, if you will, to just, you know, a handful of generations later, trying to make people like that guy, you know, the senator
Yale or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Or exactly. Like that woman, that's the head of Harvard right now, that all of a sudden it's okay to attack her because she's quote unquote anti-Semitic. So and look, everyone knows she's a diversity hire, some black lesbian with the last name of Gay, which, okay, whatever. You know, it's obviously a diversity hire situation. No one is surprised that, you know, oh, look, we found out she plagiarized, you know, her thesis. Or, well, okay. But, I mean, no one thought she got there because of scholarly works or whatever. The sooner we can get white people to just be like, yeah, you know what? Hey, I'm sorry, but our history is full of a lot of accomplishments that your history is not. It's just, there's just a difference. You know, it's like just like any other organism, right? We're just adapted to the environment in a different way. You know, just like there's certain strains of corn that thrive in this environment, but would, you know, die in this environment. It doesn't make one strain of corn better than the other. Just we're more adapted to civilization. And partially because we're the ones that created these civilizations. So, of course, they're going to be more adapted to them. And so I think it's insane. And it doesn't make any sense. There's no benefit to us. You know, it's like someone, I think it was Alt-Hype or someone figured out the actual cost of having black people in America. Like, you know, if you were to add up all of their tax revenues versus all the costs associated with a, on average, right, obviously, black people in your society, and it came up to a net loss of about it was north of $100,000. And so every black person you see walking down the street, whether it's a homeless guy on the corner screaming at people, or it's a teller, a cashier somewhere that's being rude to you or whatever. Every time you see a black person in society in America, that's $100,000 you're paying to have for that person to be in your society. So there's no financial gain. Some people would make the argument that maybe there's a cultural gain because of music and whatever, but, or if you look at the White House Christmas video, tap dancing, which is kind of a little cliche, but aside from that,
I find the thing, it's in my meme collection.
There you go.
Yeah. And I think another justification people might venture to say is, the reason we do this is that we enjoy feeling superior to them. So that's why we have them in our society. It's so that we can abuse them and be racist towards them and all that.
Well, I'll tell you, like,
there will be liberals who actually believe that.
Well, they'll say that, but here's the thing. I've never been in a position to abuse black people. So how could I enjoy it? First of all, I've been in many situations where I'm being abused by non-whites. But I've never been in a situation, I've never even had the opportunity. And I would submit that most white people are never even if that's what you wanted to do, which isn't what we want to do, but even if that's what you wanted to, there's that opportunity never presents itself in any meaningful way, which is why I think they focus on cops so much, right? Because that's like the one time that where you're going to have video of white people dominating black people because they're just doing their jobs. And so there's really that's not the case. The evidence doesn't show that to be true. And if anything, if that was my thing, if that was like my fetish was dominating other races, I would probably go to a third world country. It'd be easier to do in a third world country. It's just because you can't do it here without massive legal repercussions, or you can't even defend yourself against these people without suffering maybe life ending repercussions.
The reputation destroying repercussions for sure.
Absolutely.
But this graph is astonishing, really. And I've seen similar ones. And there was another one that I saw just recently, but I don't know where it is now, that showed that in the Netherlands, they've spent, I think it was 400 billion on immigrants, like third world immigrants, since 1995. So in the last 30 years, they've spent 400 billion euros on this. So which again rubbishes the idea that these people are an economic benefit to the country, but also that whites benefit from them being in this country. It's simply not true.
No, there's literally no benefit at all that is measurable in any kind of way, and certainly not one. If, like I said, maybe you could say, "Well, I like rap music or whatever." That certainly they can make rap music somewhere else, okay? And you can still get it on iTunes.
Yeah.
So the costs vastly outweigh the benefit. And so it doesn't make any sense unless there's a benefit, because look, we're not the ones making the decisions, obviously. So the people that are, they have to see a benefit to this. It doesn't have to be economic necessarily, but there has to be some kind of benefit that makes it worth it, right? Like, so it's like Elon Musk, right? When he buys Twitter and he's buying it for, billions of dollars or whatever, people are saying, well, it's not really worth that. Why are you spending so much money? Well, the same reason why all the venture capitalists were losing $200 million on average a year before Elon bought it on Twitter. It's because it's worth it in that you have that propaganda machine at your fingertips. It's worth it because you control the narrative in the world, really, with this tool. And so it's worth it to lose $200 million or whatever the figure was. I mean, it was never profitable. I think it ended up being profitable for maybe like a year or two towards the end. But for, I mean, it was long. It was around for like a decade before that. And so they're just sinking hundreds of millions of dollars into this thing. And not because they knew that, you know, and eventually Elon will buy it and it'll be worth something. But because it was worth it to lose that kind of money for the propaganda value of it. And I think that the value of diversity to the ruling class, and it's not just, this isn't just limited to Jews. I think this is limited to, I think Jews in particular, maybe they've got, slightly different motivations for, but ultimately it's kind of the same thing. It's, they want to get a population that's easier to control. They want a population that, you know, comes from countries that doesn't, they don't have a history like we do. It's like, okay, just if you're a farmer, I mean, it, which is how they see themselves. They see themselves, it's not just the Jews that call us Goyim that think of us as cattle. I mean, they might think of it in a more visceral religious way. But even people like, I would say even people like Tucker Carlson or something like that, they see themselves as separate to us. They see themselves as a separate class. They might not be, loyal to their race, but they're definitely loyal to their class. And they see you as almost a different species. In fact, in a way, you could say that instead of putting one pygmy in the New York Zoo, they've just put all of us in one giant zoo. And that's kind of the way they look at it. And I think that because of this, they want cattle that are easier to manage. They want animals that aren't going to get any crazy ideas that might compete with their ideas, you know, things that they want. They don't want to have, like if you were a farmer and you had to put a fence up and you had a bunch of cattle in there and you had a certain breed of cattle that was smart and they could get past the fences and you're always having to, you know, go out and rope them and bring them back in. And they were just kind of a pain in the ass, right? You don't want those kind of cattle. You want the cattle that are just going to sit there and they're going to eat the grass and shit all over the place and be ready for harvest come harvest time. And that's, I think, why they're doing it. It's not just like the, you know, especially when you hear people say, it's because they're, and they used to say this even like in the 90s, they'd say, they want to import all these voters. It's all these Democrat voters. And what, you know, okay.
Well, that's what Tucker said recently. Tucker's right. Returned to that recently, and I think it's annoying. It's unfortunate that he said that.
Yeah, no, they've been saying that forever because, and look, there's maybe like a grain of truth to that in so much that elections are even real anymore. But ultimately, it's because it's not just the policies that they'll vote for. It's the reason, it's the fact that you're importing people that think like that, that are easier to manage. There are people that want to be babysat. There are people that want you to run everything and don't want to hold you accountable. And so that's exactly, it's the kind of cattle that you want. And then when it comes time, and I think that what they're banking on is the AI and other technologies that are basically making a lot of people redundant, making a lot of, you know, like even now, right, they're making McDonald's where you order on the app. And I think I actually heard on the radio a couple of days ago that there's the first fully automated Taco Bell is, I think in California, they're going to open it up where you just, you order on the app and you drive up to a window and like tacos come out at you or something like that. And, yeah, that's, and they're like, it's going to be the future and this is what everything it is. And so as more and more of the economy becomes this kind of mechanized AI driven stuff that you don't need the people anymore to push the buttons and pull the levers and whatever. And you get into a situation where you need to get rid of all these excess people because they're just going to be, you know, they're useless. Who's going to be easier to get rid of, right? Is it going to be high IQ people who are on the same level as you intellectually and have the same kinds of abilities that you do, like an equal? Is that the kind of person that you're going to want to have to get rid of millions of? Or is it going to be these people who are not as smart and not as...
who are easily controlled, easily manipulated, easily satisfied with material bullshit. I mean,
well, they've proven that.
BLM, you know, what an easy bunch of people to control.
Right. No, and they've proven that. You can just look, because you can look at all the countries they're coming in here from. You know, they're coming in from these very authoritarian in the case of Africa or south of the border or whatever, they're coming here from countries where they have a track record. You can look at, what will they accept? What kind of tyranny will they accept? What kind of corruption will they accept? You know? Oh, okay. Well, then, that's who we want. We want these kinds of people that'll allow us to have the same kind of environment. We want to live like third world warlords ourselves. We want to have like the big money coming in from corporations, and no one smart enough to look into that and see if there's any impropriety going on. We want the people that are so docile that when a staffer gets fucked in the ass in a Senate committee room, it's no one cares really, or if they do, no one does anything about it, right? You know, because we're importing these people that don't have the same kind of a moral compass as the founding stock Americans, and so it's really kind of or if they do, they don't believe in the Second Amendment, you know, and so there's nothing really. What can they do? So it makes sense. It's worth it to them, and they don't have to deal with it. You know, it's like they don't have to deal with the repercussions. They're not living in the same neighborhoods as these people they're importing. So it doesn't matter if they're making life a living hell for the old Americans or the old Englishmen or the now irrelevant, outdated, original people that created the country. You don't need those people anymore. And so it is what it is. I'm trying to think of solutions to it. I think everyone is. I think that's why it's so important that we keep talking about this stuff so that we can come up with something, because I feel like, especially in America, you know, time is kind of running out, and coming up with a viable solution that is that something that we even have any kind of say in or any kind of control in. I'm rapidly coming to the conclusion that really all we can do at this point is try to make life as comfortable and good as possible for ourselves and our families, and focus inwardly in terms of like our families, you know, our immediate families, and then wait for some kind of black swan event or some kind of charismatic leader or something to pop up, because trying to solve a lot of this stuff politically, I don't think that's even I don't think it's an option anymore.
No, it's obvious that the political establishment in every country, but especially America, has absolutely no interest in changing the matters that we're discussing here. But a black swan event, a number of people so far on Millennial have talked about Elon Musk taking over Twitter, and you got your account back, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I had to do the request. I did the so here's the funny thing. That's my original account I had back in, like, I think 2016, and it got banned pretty quick after that the Indian lady got in charge over at Twitter. I forget her name, who cares. And then they banned because I had a link to my now banned book in my bio, and they decided that day of the rope, the phrase was hate speech or bannable offense. And so because I had a link to a book called Day of the Rope, they just banned the account. And then I made another account that I'm locked out of until I delete a tweet. It's even now, right? If I try to log into it, it's like, oh, you know, you said a naughty thing. You have to delete this tweet in order to access this account. And I won't do it because, well, first of all, I didn't say anything bad. And so when Elon first, or what the tweet was, it was literally some Jewish woman had created a sterilize yourself from home device where you literally dipped your balls into this machine that would zap you sterile. And I tweeted out like an article talking about this device. And I think the caption was just nuke your balls, Goy. And like, that's all it was. Pretty harmless, I thought. And it locked me out of my account until I delete that tweet. So when Elon bought it, I thought, oh, well, okay, well, maybe I can ask for another look at this, since this is relatively tame, even compared to the stuff I tweet out now. And it got rejected. So I was like, all right, whatever. And then like a couple weeks went by, maybe months. And then I was like, oh, you know what? I'm going to try to repeal the ban on that original account. And after like, or you know what? I don't remember if I might have sent, it might have been one of those situations. I don't remember if I did that after Elon bought it, or if it was one of those situations where you would repeal a ban and then just never hear back. And then maybe I heard back eventually after, you know, but it doesn't matter. After a certain amount of time after he bought it, I got an email saying, oh, we, you know, your account's back or whatever. So I got back on, and I've been kind of testing the limits a little bit with some of the things I've been saying. And so far, nothing terrible has happened. They haven't banned me or told me to delete anything. And I've had an acceptable, I think, amount of mainstream freedom of speech. I don't know if they're throttling my stuff or not. It's hard to know. But I know it's happened to other people.
My own experience of it so far has been very good. I've only received one. I think I was suspended for a week because I said something that could be, I didn't mean it as a threat, but it could be interpreted as a threat. It was under a BBC thing, some BBC tweet. And I said, you're such a bunch of liars or something like that. I hope you end up destitute and on the street. So something penniless and on the street, something like that. And I think they interpreted that as a threat. Like, I'm wishing harm upon the staff of the BBC. So I got a week's suspension for that. And so I remembered ever since then, I've tried to hold back from wishing ill upon people, even BBC journalists, which is actually a daily struggle.
Well, you see, and that's frustrating for me because, you know, Elon Musk, he says one thing and does another. Because that's not speech that would be illegal in America. You know, you can wish all kinds of harm. You just can't threaten it. And if you were their boss, for example, and you were saying that, then you've got the power to make that happen. So that's one thing, right? Because you're making a threat. But how are you going to make them penniless? You know, like, what are you going to do? You know, sabotage their 401k? It doesn't make any sense. So I've heard of examples of that where, you know, he said that, oh, if as long as it's not illegal in America, then, it, you know, it's fine. But then there's, I mean, how is it when you say, what was it, to the river, to the sea or whatever is now banned? And so that's super gay. And so it just seems like he's making compromises. And I don't think it's a strategic thing. I think that in some ways he has the same class loyalty that a Tucker Carlson or you know, even a Donald Trump would have, and so that's how he's looking at it. You know, he's looking at it as well. Sometimes, you know, as a leader, you know, we have to restrict the things that the peasants can say or whatever for the betterment of humanity. And I think there's a little bit of that to him. I mean, it's hard to know this guy. I mean, he has such a I don't want to say questionable past, but it just seems a little bit weird, his backstory. And, you know, being in that kind of a position with the amount of government contracts and subsidies and everything else, and just the amount of money you have. So the amount of interactions you have to be having on a regular basis, with the ruling class just to operate on, you know, in any kind of, way. And it doesn't make any sense to me that he's doing anything other than playing the game to some extent, just like everybody else, which really sucks, which really pisses me off, because at a certain point, it actually pisses me off less about him because he's generating all this money and maybe he's got some master plan or whatever. I don't know. I doubt it. But like, you know, who knows, right? But with people like Tucker, right? Tucker has hundreds of millions of dollars in the bank. And even if they tried to make him destitute and poor, you know, as you wanted to have happen to the BBC people, they couldn't. They couldn't do it. He's got fuck you money for the rest. And his kids have fuck you money, right? And so he could, without any kind of retribution whatsoever, say whatever the fuck he wanted, and the only price that he would pay would be invitations to dinner parties, and you know, really, it would be just social repercussions that wouldn't matter to any of us. And he says it doesn't matter to him. I watched his interview with Jimmy Dore a couple days ago, and he tried to make this big point to the audience, because Jimmy Dore, I don't know if you're familiar with his show or not, but he's like this comedian, lefty guy, like a Bernie bro kind of a comedian. And he comes from, you know, he's blue collar. His background is somewhat blue collar. And, but you know, he sees the world through the, like an Occupy Wall Street Democrat from like the, you know, the late 90s or whatever. And so he's come around on a couple of issues, and he's gone from just the knee jerk, I hate anyone who wants to restrict immigration, to at the very least having kind of like the Bernie Sanders, or the old Bernie Sanders view of it, of, well, it's bad because of it's bad for unions. You know, like if you increase immigration, then you're driving down the wages. And while that's true, that's not the reason why you don't want it. So he's doing this interview with Tucker Carlson, and kind of bringing up the class loyalty that's a lot of these people have. And Tucker was quick to be like, oh no, I don't understand. I don't want to be I think the quote was, I don't want to be on a private jet with Larry Fink. He's boring. You know, like, I don't know why all these people, you know, they sell their soul so they can get invited to all these, you know, dinner parties and get these merit badges from these rich people. I mean, I'm not interested in that. And, you know, I think he's either lying to us or to himself to some extent, because there's just no possible way that these people are, to any degree, like that are this race blind, but also as intelligent as I'm assuming Tucker has to be. To, you know, I know he's a trust fund kid or whatever, but he's not an idiot. And to still tiptoe around race, or even deny it, or, you know, he actively went against it, you know, saying that if there was a white leader, he would rise up against him.
He wouldn't want a white leader, like someone saying that he was Tucker's leader just because they had the same race. They were of the same race. Yeah, you know, it feels passé. It feels like, you know, I hate to say it, but it's almost like, you want to say, what is this, 2015? Yep. When Tucker comes out with this stuff, I don't think there's any need for him to say this stuff at this stage. He could be more, you know, it's frustrating. I mean, I understand people cucking when there are going to be huge consequences to them not cucking. I don't like it, but I can understand it. Right. What baffles me is when there really wouldn't be great consequences anymore. And at this stage, there wouldn't be great consequences to Tucker saying something like, well, look, there are different groups of people, and obviously we feel affinity for each other. And my group is white Americans. Right. I mean, I don't think that would cause him to lose. For Christ's sake, he's already lost his seat at Fox News. What else? What are they going to do? They're going to debank.
Well,
saying, and this, come on.
And this is where you need to revisit the reality that his dad was CIA, you know, and that he applied, quote unquote, applied to work at CIA, you know, according to him, and they didn't hire him. And so he immediately got a job in media, you know? And so at this point, it's like, you know, it with people like Tucker, where his family is CIA, and it's a family thing, you know, that it's a family business, shall we say. And, you know, even people like Alex Jones, he had family members in the CIA. And, you know, you have these, you know, like when he did that video with Stu Peters, which I've only seen clips from, to be fair. So I haven't seen the full context of it. But I mean, I've seen enough Alex Jones reacting to the mention of Jews to know, you know, that I don't need to see the full thing. Anytime you mention Jews, almost in any context that's not positive at all, he freaks the fuck out and gets very defensive.
He gets into pretzels to argue against it. You know,
the tricoms. He literally, I saw this clip posted by Adam Green on Twitter just before we came on. I'd forgotten about this. He said Jeffrey Epstein was working for the Chi-Coms. When
for fuck's sake.
Yeah, there's a video. So you can check Adam Green's timeline. But right after Epstein was found killed in his cell or whatever you believe happened there, he was in the airport, I guess, traveling. And so he did like this live stream from you know, waiting for his airplane. And he literally said that Jeffrey Epstein was working for the Chi-Coms. And it's like, okay, well, now I know who you're working for. <You know? laughs> Yeah, it's look, it is what it is. And you know, after watching the, like I said, the clips of the Stu Peters thing, I'm not like a big Stu Peters fan by any means. I mean, the guy believes in flat Earth and some other crazy shit and whatever. But I thought at least the clips that I saw, he brought up some good points, the things that made Alex really uncomfortable. And then after, I guess, that took place and I saw some of these clips going viral on Twitter, there was a space that he was in. And I was like, oh, well, I'll check, you know, Stu Peters was doing this space. And I was like, oh, I'll check it out, see if he expands on this and, you know, maybe gives you like the behind the scenes view of Alex's reaction. And he spent like the first 10 to 20 minutes kissing Alex Jones's ass and saying like how we really owe him a great debt of gratitude because, you know, he was the tip of the spear for so long. And I'm just like, what the fuck is this? And then he goes on to
people do seem to think that even though Alex Jones is, you know, cucks on this stuff and goes on about the Chi-Coms, he did blaze a trail for people. And I more agree with you. What he's done is misdirect for 20 years.
Right.
But there are people who seem to think that he was, yeah, he blazed a trail.
No, I think that, and look, there were people that he was in competition with back when he first started, back in the 80s and 90s, like Bill Cooper, for example. Bill Cooper was really canceled. I've talked about him a few times. A lot of people might be familiar from, you know, at least if you watch the opening of Red Ice, he's one of the clips that they play in the opening of the Red Ice intro. But he was this broadcaster that was kicked off of everything, and he started broadcasting. He would pay for his own satellite time or get donations to do it and broadcast up to a satellite feed that then illegal transmitters around the country that he had sold to people could then pick up the satellite feed and rebroadcast it locally. So it was like this total illegal broadcast, this pirate radio thing that he had going on. And they actually did better in the ratings than some of the legal stations in some markets. But Bill Cooper always hated Alex Jones and said he was a disinfo agent. And there was a couple other people that were saying a lot of the same stuff. And look, I'm just, you know, something about his background doesn't add up. I think that people sometimes take this the wrong way. When I say I don't trust people that come from money, they think that, oh, well, then what you're trying to do is create a situation where you're never going to have power because you're going to always be distrustful of people that have means, or you're very proud of your lack of power and your lack, you know, like lack of status and whatever. And you know, it's poor man's cope or whatever it is. But it's like, no, it's just, if you don't come from money, I know that there's no possibility that you're one of these people. Or if you are, it'll probably be something that changes. I'll be able to see you change all of a sudden, right? Because it'll be the before and after you got bought, you know, that you sold out or whatever. With these people that come from generations of family members working in intelligence, it's like, I mean, and how come they're all like that? There's so many of them that are like that. You know, it's you know, what are the odds? What are the odds that Tucker's family is ex-CIA, Alex Jones' family is ex-CIA, the guy who took over for Rush Limbaugh, he himself is ex-CIA. You know, all these ex-CIA people that are suddenly all of the popular talking heads. I mean, CNN hired a bunch of the Obama-era intelligence agency heads as contributors. Fox News does it all the time. That guy that was that's big with boomers now, he's blank on his name, but he was an old Secret Service agent. There's not really a anyone that's in mainstream that is a even remotely like a rags to riches kind of a story. There's always some kind of sus looking background, no matter how you, and look, Elon's kind of the same way. I hate to say it, you know, none of these people just came from nothing. The American dream that, oh yeah, you can be, you can come from nothing and just by hard work and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, somehow you could become president someday. That's bullshit. That's total bullshit. You have to be born into a particular class to even run for president, let alone become president. And there's never been an example in the last 100 years where that wasn't true. And so it's just, it's at a point now as we live in, and people are totally oblivious to the oligarchy that we live in, And they still believe this fantasy, right? And that's the other mind trap, right? The other mind trap that has the boomers closed down and unable to look at their country with a skeptical eye is they still believe that this, you know, I remember talking to this guy, this leftist years ago, and it was one of the few times the leftist actually made a good point when I was talking to him. It was when I was a libertarian. And he was like, oh, you know, all these right wingers, they're always voting against their own interest, you know, voting to raise taxes or whatever. And I was like, well, yeah, that's because they want lower taxes, you know, like because they're entrepreneurs and they want a big, you know, build a big business. And I didn't agree with him at the time, but now I've come to agree with him. But he made the point that, like, yeah, right. I mean, you're basically voting for tax breaks and for things that benefit rich people with this insane fantasy that, well, that's because when I'm a billionaire, I'll be able to benefit from that. Like, it's, you're not going to be a fucking billionaire, you know? You're going to retire from discount tires and you know, have like maybe some Social Security money coming to you, and you're going to go to fucking Laughlin on the weekends and drop $300 into some slot machine and chain smoke in front of it until you fucking die. And like, you're not going to be a member of the ruling class if you work your way up the company or whatever. It's never going to fucking happen. And so when you vote for all these things for the rich people, you are voting because it's like for the same reason why people buy lottery tickets, right? They're voting for a fantasy. You know, they're buying the lottery ticket not because it makes any sense because they're ever going to fucking win the lottery, but because they want to believe for a moment after they pay that money and until they hear the numbers read out on the TV, they want to believe for a second that maybe I could be the one that wins that $100 million or whatever the fuck on Powerball. And you know, even if it doesn't happen, right, they think it's worth it because they for a few moments they got to fantasize about having $100 million. And I think that's what the way that these people are thinking when they're voting for this shit. You know, that they vote for like all these tax breaks for billionaires, and they vote for all the things that benefit any, like, look at, if you look at Trump's record, like what he actually accomplished, none of that benefited the people that voted for him. I mean, it benefited the people that maybe donated to his campaign in large amounts. But no, you know, none of the actual promises that became memes came to fruition. And I think that a lot of these people don't care and they don't realize that because they're like those guys that buying the Powerball ticket. They're paying for that fucking fantasy. They're paying for the fantasy of like, oh, you know, better luck next time. You know, like, oh, I didn't become a billionaire this week, but maybe next week I'll become a fucking billionaire. And it just, it's, I don't know. It's so frustrating to see that these people are, I mean, I guess in a way it's easy to understand why they think we're like cattle. You know, I mean, I guess in a way, I mean, just frustrating for those of us who aren't.
Stuff that came up during COVID over here, that if the people are so passive and undiscerning about the stuff they're told, then is it any wonder that the elites see them as just, yeah, cattle, just masses to be manipulated like putty?
Well, and maybe that's a shift in thinking that we should have, you know, instead of thinking like, how do we get people to rise up and blah, 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 blah. It's like, well, maybe they shouldn't, you know, because if you think about the Revolutionary War in America, the majority of people, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but I mean, it wasn't like, you know, 90% of the people in the colonies wanted to break away from England. It was really a small number of people that got that ball rolling, and they went and did it. And when the deal was done, people just kind of were like, okay, well, I guess we're going with the winners. And I think that generally speaking, that's how the public is. And so it's maybe not, I mean, we're all hung up on on getting people to have some self-respect and think for yourself. But it's just like, that's like arguing with cattle, trying to reason with them. It's like, no, you can't reason with people they're born to be cattle. So maybe it's time to stop looking at it in terms of getting people to wake up, red pill the normies, and it's not going to fucking happen. Maybe we need to start looking at how do we manipulate these people, and how do we try to figure out. I can't really say this stuff. Some of the other stuff I was going to say.
Okay.
But fine. figure out other means of changing things around. Let me just put that.
Yeah. Up. Yeah. How to lead them. I agree. I think that most people are very passive, and that's what has been proven. It's what the elites have known all along. Now, this comes as a surprise to us, because I think we had imbibed the whole idea about democracy and all that and speaking truth to power. But I think the elites have known all along that it's really not like that. And good luck trying to animate the masses.
They're really sheep.
Sorry, go on.
No, it's a nice little fairy tale. And, even the founders didn't believe it. I mean, we're not a democracy or a republic. And they designed it that way for a reason, because they didn't trust even the founding stock Americans to make kind of those kinds of decisions. They knew there had to be some kind of hierarchy. They knew that there had to be some kind of situation where you've got the best and brightest, hopefully. I mean, probably not in reality, but that's the theory, right? That you're going to get like your alphas, the best and brightest of your group. You elect them as representatives, and then they're the ones calling the shots, right? You're not putting everything on the ballot. You're putting who's the best guy out of all of us to go make these decisions for us, right? And then we can have that guy go and do it. You're supposed to keep doing whatever you're doing, being a farmer, a blacksmith, or whatever the fuck. Like, you're not supposed to be making decisions on every little thing that happens, because quite frankly, you're not capable of it. There's a reason why you're a baker, not a policymaker. You might be really good at making bread, but geopolitics is not your thing, and it doesn't have to be. Why would you want it to be? And I think that's the thing is, inevitably what happens maybe in every system, but what has certainly happened in this system is we're no longer, and for how long, I don't know, this has been going on, but it's no longer, let's get everyone to vote on who the best guy is in our group. It's been like a select few of people with a lot of fucking money who have just been selecting these people that are going to do what they want. And that's the situation right now. That's who's in Washington right now. It's not the best and brightest out of the communities that they represent. In fact, a lot of these people aren't even from them. It's almost like a professional sports ball where these teams have, the name and the town, but most of the players, they're not from that town. That might've been how it was originally, right? Let's make a baseball team. We'll call ourselves the Albuquerque Isotopes, and like the best baseball players in Albuquerque are going to go and play on the Isotopes. And we're going to play against like the Denver Donkeys or whatever the fuck. And that's like a competition between two different communities and whatever, but that's not what it ended up. And that's how it started. Right. But now you've got people who aren't even from the same country. I mean, obviously with you guys, it's like World Cup, and it's like aptly named World Cup, because it seems like the people playing are from all over the fucking world. Doesn't matter what the actual country name is or the flag or whatever. And so that's kind of what I think our representative government has kind of turned into, right? It's no longer like, who's the best guy who most represents the heart and soul of our community. It's just who has the most money, who's getting paid from the multinational or even who's not getting blackmailed or primaried by Jewish interest groups and this sort of a thing. So the whole system is fucked. There's no way that because they control the monetary system too. It's kind of like, they're too big to fail. There'll never be a situation. 2008 proved that. There's never going to be a situation where, even if they miscalculate to the degree that it financially ruins them, they'll just make you pay for it. They'll just raise your taxes and make you pay for it, print some money, whatever. It's all fake and gay anyway, so who cares? And so there's never going to be a political solution to this, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. No, well, I do agree with that, at least in the case of America and probably Britain as well. Well, definitely Britain as well, because of our voting system. It's completely stupid. But yeah, I think with these countries, you've got the endless pendulum between the left and the left-wing party and, well, the so-called left-wing party and the so-called right-wing party. And that, you know, befuddles the public. It gets them involved in this. And then they get invested in it. You know, they really care about smashing the opposition and how evil the how corrupt the opposition party is. And almost actually like, as you were saying about football teams, our football team's the best. The others are cheats and incompetent and all the rest of it. People get invested in a similar way, talking about the Dems. And I don't know what the Republicans are called. And it's all absolute nonsense. This is something that came again during COVID. It really came into view for me. When people were still talking about the rivalry between Nicola Sturgeon, who was the First Minister of Scotland, and Boris Johnson, who was the Prime Minister of Britain. And I thought, who fucking cares? What difference does this make to anything, really? These are two puppets, and they don't really have many ideas. They certainly don't have much real power between them. So, and who cares about their arguments? Who cares about what they think about each other? It's all meaningless. It's all irrelevant. It's all just a soap opera to keep you occupied, to keep you hoping. And I think this it does work for many people, and they don't think about, for example, the money power, and they certainly don't think about, you know, globalist powers. So, yeah, it's a system that works. You can't blame the elites for using it because it clearly works. Anyway, there was a question here from Black Pigeon Pilled. It said, please give Black Pilled my profound thanks. He's done great work, which I've appreciated for many years. The Woodlander's confusion on Yule 21 gave rise to my handle, and I wish you to fill him in if he's unaware. Merry Christmas to you both. Yeah, the Woodlander got confused between Black Pilled and Black Pigeon Speaks. And I think he referred to you as Black Pigeon Pilled. And so this commenter, took on that name as his name. So there you go. That's the etymology there.
Okay.
Yeah. There are actually quite a few super chats from your fans. And of course, there's heavy overlap. Okay, here we go. Chief says, both of you guys are heroes. Well, thank you very much, Chief. I appreciate that. No Chance says, will there be a Day of the Rope 2? Can I get a Get in the Pit bumper for those who haven't heard it? All right, so will there be a Day of the Rope, a sequel to Day of the Rope?
Yes, and it's I was trying to get it done in before Christmas. Not likely, and if it is, it'll be like right before, like you probably it won't get there to you before Christmas. I know people wait a long time for it. It's just that I've had to do a lot of rewrites just because of everything that keeps changing. It seems like if I wait like a month, that like everything seems outdated in it already, you know, and especially after COVID and all that stuff. And then, so I started including stuff about like a pandemic, and then like now that seems dated, you know. It's kind of like there's lessons to be learned from it and whatever. Maybe I should include that. But the whole point of writing this kind of fiction is to include things in there that are meaningful. And maybe I'm just too self-critical and I've read it too many times and I hate it. Yeah. Like I hate my first book too. Cause like you've read it so many times and you've gone over every little thing. You're just like, it all just sounds terrible to you. But, I think that's just how a lot of people are, that, you know, it's like when you edit videos, the same thing, right? You edit it you've seen the same clip like a million times and it doesn't.
Oh God. Yes.
Doesn't have the same ring as someone who watches your video for the first time. Like, oh, that's good. And you're like, oh, that's cause you haven't seen it. Like, 50,000 times like me, you know?
Yeah. I don't know about you, but I find that writing fiction takes so long compared to writing, like I've been doing essays on Substack this year, and it takes a few days to write an essay. It takes like maybe a week in total to write a long one. And you might finesse it after that, but whatever. But the point is that with a short story, it can take ages, weeks.
And I don't have one of these brains where I can just, you know, where it just spews out. I don't. And no, also,
you've got to think about everything. You've got to think of every, like, why is this character there? What's he wanting? And where does he come from? What's his background? So everything has to be thought out. It takes a long time to write fiction.
Right. And meantime, I've been doing the stream, which every one of those streams takes multiple days of research. I'm doing two a week, and it's just like, you know, like if I didn't do the stream for like a month, it'd be out, you know, because I'd be able to give my brain a rest for a couple of days and then dive in there with a fresh mind.
Because you've got to get into a different, for me, I'm speaking for myself here. Forgive me if this doesn't apply to you, but I've got to get into a certain state of mind. It's so difficult to just switch immediately from, okay, I'm doing this today and tomorrow I'm going to be doing something completely different that requires a completely different state of mind.
Well, there's a reason authors famously go to the middle of nowhere in some cottage to write their novel and stuff. God,
And I'd love to do that. I'd love to go to like get a cottage for a few weeks and just create something unique and unconnected to what I usually do. That'd be really nice. Yeah, I'd like that. But I can't because people want my regular work. So I've got to make a living.
Well, the thing is, I look at my stream as my full-time job, so it's hard to just be like, oh, I'm going to take a month off, guys. And, you know, I mean, I think people would be understanding, but it's, you know, I think it's hard to do that, especially as a broadcaster, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And some people would be understanding, but it's a matter of pragmatics. You need money to do this stuff. And they might not like the work that you did at the end of it, that you brought out, you know, because they like your regular stuff. So it's difficult. It's a difficult thing.
You took a month off for this? They read it. They're just like, this is terrible.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, if you're doing fiction, then your regular fans might not like, they might not be into fiction. So why should they, from their point of view, why should they pay for it? Awkward situation. I do understand. All right. And there was another one that I was going to bring to you. Oh, someone asked me, have you seen A Time to Kill? And because Frody, you probably know that Frody Midyear did a really good stream about this with American Krogan about 6 months ago. But the film and the novel and the reality, it's exactly the kind of thing that you usually do. So have you seen A Time to Kill?
I just looked it up. I have not seen this.
Oh, well, I'll send you a link to Frody's stream about it because I think you would find it very interesting indeed.
Sandra Bullock, huh? No, it's got, you know, it's funny is Samuel L. Jackson used to follow me on Instagram until he realized I was an evil Nazi. I think he saw Blackpilled and just thought I was some black guy because I was posting all this BLM riot footage on there. And someone was like, why is Samuel L. Jackson following you? I was like, what? Jenny, sure enough, he was. But that account is now banned. But he followed it for the whole time until it got banned.
Wow. Well, yeah, Samuel L. Jackson, that would be pre-Pulp Fiction. And Sandra Bullock, I guess it was pre-Speed as well. So, yeah, a moment. I think it was 93 or something like that. It's a complete distortion of something that did actually happen in America. And John Grisham wrote a novel about it. And then they did a film of it. And I don't remember where the distortions came in, whether it was by John Grisham in his book or the script adaptation. I can't remember. But, amazing stuff where they completely switched the races of everyone involved so as to make an anti-white film.
Well, I suspect it probably happened when it made it to Hollywood. But I remember being annoyed when I first saw Jurassic Park because, like, the girl was the computer hacker and the black guy was the head of the computer, room or whatever.
Well, wasn't that Samuel L. Jackson as well?
Yeah, that was also Samuel L. Jackson. But I remember even when I was a kid thinking, like, this doesn't seem realistic. Maybe the morbidly obese Jew, but like, you know, the rest of it just doesn't make any sense. And then I read the book, and that's not how the book is at all. Like, the girl in the book is like screaming and scared the entire time and retarded, and, you know, like, that's not at all how the book is. So I think that, this, you know, Spielberg got his hands on, you know, they bought the rights and they can do whatever they want at that point. You know, once you sell the rights to your story to Hollywood, they've got creative license to change it however they want. So I think that might've been something that happened, but I don't know Grisham's politics. I'd have to, you know, for all I know, he's the one that did it, but.
I've got a feeling, my memory is that it was him who did it.
Well, remember the other Grisham book where they forced the race mixing stuff in there? Because I read that book. It was it wasn't the Firm. It was like the
Pelican Brief.
Yeah, where they threw Julia Roberts with Denzel Washington. I remember I read that book, and then I went to go see the movie when it came out, and was just like grossed out half the movie because.
Yeah. That was the second big Grisham. The first one was The Firm with Tom Cruise. And then The Pelican Brief was the second one. And then basically they adapted every single novel that he put out. And David Fincher did one. Was it The Game? Forgotten. But yeah, it was loads of, he must be worth a fucking fortune, John Grisham. I mean,
oh yeah,
unbelievable, really. Because there was a moment like in the late 90s when he was just his stuff was everywhere. So anyway, okay. Yeah. So A Time to Kill, you should definitely seek that one out. Okay. Soaker City says, anybody of significance in public life gets approached by the CIA. It's exactly equivalent to the SS or Communist Party. This is my understanding. Do you agree? Well, I think what Black Pills is saying is that it's ancestral. Tucker's father and grandfather were in the CIA.
Yeah. No, I think that's, they keep it in the family. I mean, you know, Obama's mom was in the CIA. Tucker's father was in the CIA and dealt with communications. And I think it was Alex Jones's grandfather, but I know his father was tied into intelligence too. Yeah, but that's the thing is, I feel like it's a family business, you know. And yeah, you might get approached if you've got a unique skill, but you tend to find, in my experience at least, that the people that are tied in with the CIA are unusually wealthy and come from generational wealth. Like, I don't think there's very many stories of a CIA guy who doesn't have that kind of a wealthy background.
Yeah. Okay. And Drywall says, throw the shoes in the pit. Is that a reference to something?
I don't know what the shoes are, but I know what the pit is.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Bose and Devin, for all that you do. Merry Christmas and good Yule. Thank you very much, BMC. I'm not going to read that number at the end of your name, but thank you, BMC. Judy, great millennial so far. Shalom. Thank you very much, Judy. Drywall says, I love lamp. I have no idea what that means. Jake's channel says, thanks, Woz and Devon, for all your work. If I may, what would you say to the people working for the regime, FBI, Big Pharma, etc.? I cannot get my head around how they do what they do and live with themselves. Thanks. That's interesting.
Well, you know, I don't know that you'd have, if you were in a position to make some kind of institutional difference. I mean, I don't know. It's something that it really, I don't think there's any blanket advice for that sort of a thing, because look, I did contract work for government agencies, some of which were tied to the Intel community, but it wasn't like it was doing like video work or, you know, does graphic design work because through a government contractor. So it, you know, one week it would be make this pamphlet for, you know, NIH or and then the next day it would be like make it for DOD or, you know, make this, you know, little propaganda video for, you know, whatever. So it was, when I was doing like this work, but you were, because it was the people, the decision makers on these projects were always like the higher ups. In some case, they were actually Obama appointed, you know, political people. So you'd go to these meetings with these people. And the one thing that shocked me the most, when I went to my first meeting with, you know, the DOD people, for example, I was expecting like old white guys wearing like military stuff. You know, I didn't know what it was going to be like. And so I show up to this meeting to talk about like, it was some 3D animation, you know, video that I was doing that showed how some weapon worked or something. And, it was a room full of basically blue haired, HR ladies. You know, they didn't all have blue hair. In fact, I don't think any of them had blue hair, but like, you know, that personality type, it was a bunch of boss girls. Like, I think there was maybe a couple guys in the room, but it was all the people with any kind of power were just these women with chips on their shoulder. In fact, I felt like they didn't like that. When I showed up, that they already didn't like that I was a guy. Like that there was too much, because I came in the room, there was too much testosterone in the room. Like I was making them uncomfortable by being there. Like it was really weird. And that was every time I would meet with people, decision makers in these, you know, whether it was at the State Department or whether it was at, you know, NIH or whatever, it didn't matter what agency, it was almost exclusively women. And it, which was shocking to me. And now look, I'm pretty low on the totem pole at this point. I wasn't, you know, doing video work for like the president or something like that. Maybe it would have been like a different story if you get up higher up in the organizations, but these weren't like the lowest people either. You know, a lot of these people were pretty high up. Some of these people were like at the director level and stuff like that, and all women. And it was just, that was really shocking to me. So I don't think that if you're a white guy in one of these organizations, and if you don't believe me, just look at the recruiting ads for the CIA and stuff like that. I don't think that you really would have an opportunity to make any kind of institutional change. If you're already there and you've got a career path and whatever, you know, look, that's a decision you got to make. Maybe there's some way you can make that work towards our advantage. And that's something maybe you should think about. If not, maybe you should just do something else and not give them your labor anymore.
Yeah, I mean, female managers, there are competent women who are good at management, but and I think
I feel all, like women are good at project management, but they suck at like actually administrating things.
Yeah, I mean, there have always been women in the community who did things, who got things done and whatever. They're not innovators like men, but they are good at running something. But as soon as it comes,
they're good at nagging, is what it is. They're good at, hey, you're supposed to have this to me by Thursday. And you're like,
it's the skills that are there that, you know, that would be relevant to a mother with right. small kids, and they are good at that. But with anything that, put it this way, a lot of women, once they get power, it just goes to their heads. They become mad. The nurse ratchet thing comes in, and they're a nightmare. Everyone. I don't think I've ever heard someone say anything other than I've had female bosses and it was a nightmare.
Yeah.
Everyone who talks about this says it's a nightmare having a female boss.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've never stayed for any significant amount of time at any job where my direct boss was a woman. That was always an intolerable situation for me.
Well, you're just so sexist.
All right.
All right. Canine Friend says, enjoying the stream and your conversation comments. Merry Christmas. Thank you very much. Now let's see. The next one was Arch Stanton says, ever since 2020, I feel like I'm losing my marbles trying to figure out what's a PSYOP and what isn't, or who's a Trojan horse candidate, like Javier Milei or Giorgio Meloni. Giorgia Meloni. Ever feel like you're losing your mind trying to figure out what's real? Actually, no. I think it's fairly obvious. Like most people are in the public eye, in government. And I mean, I don't think content creators are really in, well, then again, they are. I mean, BreadTube was connected with the CIA and all that, I believe, with via Vosh. And wasn't there another one who, and there was something that he was getting funded by Philosophy Team or something. I can't remember who. I don't want to say something wrong that's untrue here. But look, I think content, yeah, there is some there. But most people in like our sphere, I don't think they're feds. I think a lot of them, I mean, there's sociopathy, there's narcissism, but I don't think they're feds. Within the proper, like the real media, the traditional, like legacy media, and within politics, almost everything is fake, is put up. It's what you would call a psyop. And you can find, and you can see the ones that aren't when they do something that really doesn't benefit them, like Andrew Bridgen, when he talked about the vaccine, that only disadvantaged him. And I think, so I believe that he's genuine, but you know, virtually everyone else is, it's orchestrated, I would say. And quite clearly.
Yeah, I just assume that everyone that is pushed in any capacity on the mainstream media is relatively fake and gay. Like, just even the Jordan Peterson, you know, where he started out like not being as fake and gay, like, or at least that was the perception. And then later, you know, became faker and gayer as time went on. I think he was always that fake and gay. And I was immediately suspicious when they were pushing that interview he did, that famous interview that launched him into the stratosphere with that BBC woman that was, so you're saying then, as soon as I saw how often that was being shared and how it was basically wall to wall clips from that interview, I'd never heard of this guy. And now all of a sudden it's everywhere. I was immediately suspicious of that. Of him.
And also how YouTube used him as the what's the word, like the cul-de-sac, the dead right. end for everyone, like whoever you're watching, the recommended video will be a Jordan Peterson video.
Yeah.
So they need him on the platform as this thing, as the ultimate, the extreme, the most outrageous thing that you could possibly watch.
Right.
He's useful to them as that. I don't know if he was. Yeah, I mean, he was definitely pushed. I think he was agreed upon as a useful, well, what I've just described.
Same thing with that.
But I can't think what the word is.
Well, the same with the new Argentine president. I mean, look, sorry, Americans, we just don't give a fuck about Argentina politics. And so all of a sudden my timeline's full of all these tweets about some guy running for president in Argentina and how based he is. And he doesn't even, it's not, the clips aren't even in English. And so they're like subtitled, and I'm like, okay, well, that's weird. And the more that I'm seeing these fucking clips, the more I'm like, okay, well, obviously he can't possibly be this guy that's coming out, you know, the salt of the earth guy that's going to get Argentina back on track. And then sure enough, you know, next thing you know, one of those clips getting shared is him waving an Israeli flag and shit. And you're like, okay, I just assume everyone that gets promoted to that degree is fake and gay.
Yeah, and every politician who seems to get anywhere does have some kind of connection with Israel. Someone also just said about Jordan Peterson that they were advertising his book at, I think it's 12 Rules for Life, on bus stops in Britain. And I do remember seeing that kind of thing, which again tells you, well, he can't be that outright. He can't be that
far. Yeah, I can't even sell my book, let alone advertise it.
And certainly not on bus stops in another country. I mean,
right. That's
just unimaginable. So, yeah. But Jordan Peterson, I mean, God, I could talk about him for ages. And I did last year with Asha Logos on here. I just see him as a, like Greta Thunberg, he's a rather dysfunctional, broken person who has been taken up by powerful people to be used for their purposes. And like Greta Thunberg, I don't think he really understood that.
Well, he exactly fits the profile, you know, like he's a drug addict, probably kind of some kind of sexual deviant of some sort, you know, and he's not sane. Like he's not well, you know, like I don't care. Like almost every interview, he drops some major hint that like he's mentally unstable, whether it's because he bursts into tears over nothing or says weird shit like he didn't sleep for a month or just he just sounds generally unwell. And those are the kinds of people that they want. You want people that are, you know, that's the easiest person to compromise, some mentally unstable drug addict, you know, with a whore daughter.
What a lovely summary there.
I had to throw a whore daughter in there.
I've actually seen him in real life. I could have introduced myself to him. About a year ago, he was in London, and I was at this show and he was there in the audience and people, once he was spotted, people started crowding around him, saying hello, getting his autograph and all this. And I was about 5 meters away from him and my friend was egging me on. He said, go and introduce you. You never know. You know, he might appear on Millennial or something. And I thought, he's never going to do that. And
right.
And I really don't like, I don't admire him. And
No,
I don't like him. I don't like him because he is a fraud, and he knows he's a fraud. And
well, he reacts the same way Alex Jones does when you bring up the Jews. It's that, you know, that's all you need to know about him.
Oh, worse than Alex Jones.
Right.
I mean, he's actively lying all the time. I would say he's much worse about that than Alex Jones. And he's explicitly said that one of his proudest things is that he guides young white men away from nationalism, from identitarianism. Right. So
he's the anti-us.
Absolutely, fuck him. I mean, he is the worst of traitors.
Yeah,
because he knows the state of the world. He knows how vulnerable we are. He knows how bad the situation is. He knows that group identity works for other people. He celebrates group identity in the case of the Jews, but he constantly discourages it in us, while he knows we are being specifically attacked. So I hope he burns in fucking hell.
Oh, he will.
Fuck him. Fuck him.
That guy's not making it through the pearly gates.
When you enumerate the attributes here of what he's doing, it's fucking egregious.
Yeah.
Right, you wanted to say something.
No, I just agree. I agree with everything you're saying. He's just the worst kind of human being, and the exact kind of human being I mentioned in my stream last night, and I'll be careful how I say this, but basically, one of the reasons why our ruling class is so bad is that they in the same way that we're having dysgenics among the general public, and you know. Dutton, of course, talks about like the removal of a lot of these selection pressures that would normally be eugenic, you know, and create strong, smart people. And because of the accomplishments of those strong, smart people, it's kind of created a situation where those pressures have been removed. And now we're getting more of a dysgenic public. Well, the same kind of a thing is taking place in the ruling class just in a different way, right? When they fuck up, they don't have to worry about pitchforks coming out anymore. There's no selection pressures being applied to the ruling class. So instead of being dysgenic in the way that, you know, you'd see in maybe the South Side of Chicago, you're having a totally different kind of mutation going on in the ruling class that's rewarding the worst kind of behavior. And, maybe it's time for some selection pressures as well.
Yeah, indeed. Well, so that was why I didn't introduce myself to Jordan Peterson, because, and that was before all of this stuff recently with Israel. Someone just quoted him saying, give him hell, Netanyahu. Jesus Christ. Well, what can you say about that? Absolutely despicable. Okay. Right, so Roger says, Woz and Devin, been listening to you since the YouTube days. I love this format, Woz, and look forward to it each year. Thank you very much. Devin, your show is after my bedtime, lol. Well, as I said at the start, it's good. You can listen to it on repeat. There's nothing wrong with listening to it on repeat, like than the replay, I mean. And that's what I was doing the last few months. Okay, Shambolic says, Merry Christmas and good Yule, gents.
and to all your listeners and guests. Appreciate all that you do. Thank you very much, Shambolics. And then there's a very generous super chat again from Penelope. Thank you very much, Penelope. And she says, thanks for always having Devin on Millennial. Well, he's a regular and he's always, people always want him. And it's always a pleasure to talk to him. So, of course, I always invite him on.
She's always been a very generous supporter, and I appreciate her being here.
Oh, right. I see. Well, she also donated very generously on the Jared Taylor stream. So thank you, Penelope. It means a lot. Let me see if I've missed any. I don't think I... Oh, right. The Geezer says, here's some pennies for the pot, Wozy, for the effort. Cheers. And thank you. And moreover, to both of you chaps, I send good Yule wishes and lucky tidings for the new year to come. That's very kind of you, the Geezers. Thank you very much. And, okay, I think that's them all. Excellent. So I went to the Super Chats maybe a bit too early, but I was thinking they might start piling up, so it might be a good idea to start them earlier on than usual. I don't know if there's anything else to say. Do you have any? do you want to say anything briefly about this recent conflict with Gaza, with Israel, the Gaza, and all that? Because I think it's interesting. I think it's going to have repercussions for a long time, actually.
Well, I just think that it's a little embarrassing for all these Muslim groups that claim to be holding the line. You know, like Hezbollah and all these. Groups that talk a big game and then they apparently don't deliver. I was kind of expecting, because of the what was early my perceived what I perceived as the environment over there with Hezbollah lining up on the border and Iran talking about their supersonic missiles and all this other stuff. I thought, and in the U.S. sending aircraft carriers out there, and I thought we might very well see some kind of a big world conflict, especially given what was going on in Ukraine and, with the tensions with China and everything else. Like, it seemed like the stage was being set for maybe a pretty big conflict. And look, it's still not over. Like, there could be something that comes of this. There's always the risk of something like that happening. But honestly, I'm kind of bored of it now. I'm kind of just like, okay, until I see a mushroom cloud over Tel Aviv or something like that, like, I'm kind of just, like, oh, though the Israelis are indiscriminately bombing the Gazans. Oh, they've been doing that since like the 90s or before that, really. So it's like, I get it. And yeah, it kind of shows, like, people could say, well, it shows the world, how inhumane they are or whatever. And, we're getting all these young people who are certain that they're not under the spell of the Holocaust anymore. And they're actually against the Israelis. And it's like, okay, well, that's the thing, is they're against the Israelis because they see them as white colonizers. They're on the right side, but for all the wrong reasons. And not in a way that's beneficial to us. And which, by the way, does not mean, therefore, let's embrace the Jews and get them on our side. And we scratch their back, they'll scratch ours. No, they've proven that's not ever going to happen. So we're just kind of stuck in the middle, I think. We're kind of just stuck as observers and to see where this leads. And I'm not convinced that it won't lead to some kind of maybe a black swan type of an event, even out here in the West, eventually. But urgency and the rhetoric, even the rhetoric, because that was the thing too, is Israel was talking a big game. They were talking about how they were going to go in there and just wipe them all out and all, which is kind of what they're doing. They're just doing it slow enough to where it apparently, they're boiling the frog at just the right temperature. But all these Arab countries, I think ultimately you got to think of it this way. A lot of these Arab countries, they're only like, their ruling class is only pretending to give a fuck about Gaza because they know their people give a fuck about Gaza. But you think the Saudi royals really give a fuck about Gaza? You don't think that they're not tight with the Israelis, economically and otherwise? I mean, there's a lot of these Muslim countries where the ruling class is perfectly happy to do business with the Jews and perfectly happy to to have their presence in the Middle East because of the economic boon that they've been experiencing themselves due to the oil, and they'd love to sell and trade with Israel, and so it's more right now just that they have to save face with their populations. They have to make it look like they're crying a tear for Gaza or whatever. But I don't think with maybe the exception of Iran, I don't think it may be Syria also, but only because they've got skin in the game, you know, being right there. I don't think there's really a whole lot of these ruling class Arab decision makers that give a fuck about what's happening in Gaza. So I don't think that would really spiral out of control in a way that it would have to. I kind of feel like we already toppled all the governments that would have, like Saddam's Iraq weakened them, like in Afghanistan or something like that. I think that anyone that could have done something about it that would have escalated this to a war where you're seeing an invasion of the occupied portions of Palestine, if you will. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think Hezbollah is going to cross the line. If anything happens, I mean, I could see them doing kind of a false flaggy kind of a thing and blaming it on Iran and say, well, we've already got this aircraft carrier out here. Might as well go bomb the fuck out of Iran. And maybe that spirals out of control because people keep forgetting that Iran's not, they're not the same. They're not these low IQ, goat herding Afghanis. Iran is a higher IQ population with more sophisticated weapons and technology and relations with countries like Russia and stuff like that. But in the meantime, it kind of just it feels like they don't want to rock the boat. Like the people in charge, it's almost like how the boomers, right? They want to keep the status quo going as long as possible so they can ride their RV out into the sunset. And so when it all comes crashing down, they're 6 feet under and it doesn't matter anymore. And I kind of feel like that's maybe what the people, the decision makers in Washington are, how they're looking at this too, is it's, well, this isn't ideal. This is what it's not what we want to happen. And increasingly, as you have maybe Muslims and people the kinds of people that are protesting at Harvard and stuff like that, these younger people that are weaseling their ways into these institutions and working at the State Department and stuff like that, and being a little more
actions getting them there,
right? Yeah, like those people are. I think that as much as they might want to change course, they're still ultimately they don't have the power that they would need to change course. So I think everyone's just kind of, I just think it's going to be, I think by the, when it's all over and unless something crazy happens, and something crazy can always happen, they'll just bomb Gaza out of existence. And it'll be a really long, I mean, look, these guys play the long game. If you ask them, they've played the long game for 2000 years, right? Just to get it going. So, they don't mind waiting a little bit longer. They feel like they waited 2,000 years. They can wait a couple hundred or whatever, or 10 or 20. It's not a big deal. And I think they're just going to bomb the shit out of Palestine like they've been doing, out of Gaza and everything, and make it uninhabitable, send the people out to Western countries, and then just annex it, like they've been doing everything else. I can't see it going any other way. Unless someone else steps in, and no one else is stepping back in. Israel's even conducting attacks directly on Hezbollah, and they're not crossing into the border into Israel. They're just hanging out. So, like I said, wake me up when there's a mushroom cloud over Tel Aviv or something like that. I just don't see anything happening until if you have a real army, because it would take a real army. Or at the very least, like a Hezbollah kind of a force. You have something like that crossing the border into Israel, then yeah, shit's going down. But until then, it's just a lot of talk.
Right. Okay. Complicated. I won't give. I mean, I've talked about it myself and others on other occasions. Okay, yeah, there are other super chats. For some reason, the pop-out wasn't showing all of them. I've no idea why. So I'll go through them again and hopefully not miss any this time. B. Dawson says, Merry Christmas, Devon. What videos or content are you most proud of? Defiant and Land of My Ancestors hit me really hard and are both amazing.
That I'm most proud of? I mean, I don't know. I'll tell you what. I've done so many streams, it's hard to know. But basically, I usually I'll do a stream and I'll have a sense afterwards as to how well it went. And the audience doesn't always react the way that I think they're going to. But I'm usually at least in the ballpark of where I can usually estimate, like, okay, this one's going to do really well, this one's not. But they don't always, you know, they don't always coincide with how I feel I did. Defiant took a long time to do. Because just hunting down all those clips and editing it and putting the music in, that was probably one of the ones I spent the most time on. And I'm proud of the impact it's made for sure. I didn't think it was going to take off the way that it did. Especially once I was off YouTube and everything, right? Because you go to my YouTube channel, I was surprised. I referenced an old YouTube video I had done, and I went to go play it on stream the other day, and it had like 480,000 views. And I was just like, fuck, I forgot that I used to get views like that on YouTube, you know? And that's like 500,000 views on this fucking thing. And it's a shame that we don't have access to those eyeballs anymore. I mean, if I had to guess, I mean, it's hard to know how many views Defiance had because it's been posted so many different places. But I doubt it's probably even up to that level. You know, I don't think it's half. Maybe it is. I don't know. But yeah, I would say I mean, proud of. I mean, it's hard to know. It's hard to say. I'm very self-critical too. So not to quote a drug addicted Jew, but but Amy Winehouse once said before killing herself, she said something like, "You're only as good as the last thing you made," and like that's what drove her. And I know it's a weird person to quote, but like that's kind of how I feel.
Who said that?
Amy Winehouse.
Oh God.
Yeah, I know. But like that's a quote that I think she said it like, you know, well, when she was still alive, obviously it was like 10 plus years ago. And at the time I was doing, I've always done the same kind of a workflow where, I'm working on a commercial or I'm working on this video. And then as soon as it's done, it's in the can, bam, it's gone. I like almost don't think about it ever again. Because then you're on to the next one. And there is a part of my personality that's like, always needing to treat everything that I've done like this has to be the best thing I've ever made. Everything I make has to be, you know, and when it falls short, like it disturbs me because I feel like, yeah. Oh, I've lost it. Yeah.
I have exactly the same tendency. I like doing live streams because once each one is done, that's it. And I forget about it. There's no real ability to finesse it. Therefore, I don't get into the paralysis of finessing it.
Right.
But if you can finesse it, then you get into that and it can take ages and then you never want to, you know, release it because there's always more improvement that can be done.
It's right.
Definitely a problem.
Right. Which is probably what's going on in my book right now. You know, it's the same sort of thing. It's like, you know, but once it's, you know, out there, once it's, you know, it's been released, I tend to not really think about it. Like it's always funny when people will say like, oh, remember when you did this stream or whatever? And I'm like, kind of. I remember researching that, I guess, now that I'm thinking about it. And which is another reason why I take it so seriously, because to me, I'm just saying maybe something offhanded. And but, you know, there's 20, 30,000 people listening at any given moment. And you never know how whatever you said is going to affect someone. And so you have to be very mindful of that and take that responsibility seriously. And which just adds to that, you know, the whole thing of like, oh, this has to be, I have to nail this. This has to be good. But yeah, it's real hard to answer that question. Cause like, Honestly, I don't really, you know, I once, when I was doing the video work that I used to do in my former life, there's these low key, it's like a, it's an offshoot of the Emmys that they do every year. It's like local Emmys basically. And you send your project to them and you pay a little entrance fee. It's not that much. It's like $50 or whatever. And it gets judged by some panel for different categories. And if you win, you can actually buy, it's a money-making thing for them because you can buy the statue and it looks like a real Emmy. It's like this big metal, you know, winged angel thing. Like it looks like legit, like an Oscar. It looks like a real award, even though it's like some stupid corporate video that you made that maybe 100 people watched, right? That was for a very limited audience. And the company I used to work for is kind of like a way of morale boosting or whatever, would pay to send your stuff off and pay for the statue if you won one and stuff like that. I ended up having like, I had like 20 of these fucking things, like just stacked up. Like it was really, I remember the first one I got, I was like really kind of proud. I was like, yeah, I got like a, like an Oscar kind of a thing. Like, you know, and then as I got more and more of these, I was like, man, they must just give these to everybody. And when I left one of my last jobs, I literally just left all the statues like at my desk because I was just like, I don't fucking care about these things. You know, there's just, there's more shit I got to move. So I just, you know, I just don't, I don't like to live in the past when creatively. I like to always be looking ahead.
Yeah, I understand that. Okay, there was another one from, oh yeah, Potato Mutt. Hey, Devin, since you've been so fascinated with Madison Grant's Pygmy at the Bronx Zoo, there's a film from 1993 directed by Robert De Niro about race relations in the Bronx during integration in the 60s.
Oh, here we go. This is the Bronx tale.
Yeah, you should you should cover it on Insomnia Stream.
Oh, God. I will eventually. I will eventually. Not because I want to.
All right. Land of the Fake says, one thing I want to point out about that racial budget impact graph, if whites are putting the world on our backs and we go extinct, then reality may never see civility ever again. Well, yeah, it's a frog and the scorpion thing. If they do outbreed us, then they're fucked. Because, but yeah, they're not.
Well, unless the technology out, you know, keeps in pace with that. I think that's the little, that's the balancing act that they're doing, is they know that what these people are capable of. I mean, the ruling class, I mean, some of them are stupid, but a lot of them aren't stupid.
And it's like this meme here. I should just put it up on screen there. It's illustrating a reality that I think we all know very well. Sorry.
Right, but I think on the realistic version, on one side, it would be robots. You know, like it's going to be...
Yeah, like, yeah, AI, automation, yeah, all of that.
Right, so, and in fact... On one side, it'll be robots, and then the other side will be they won't be there. Because once the ruling class has no use for these people, you think they're going to be around? And, you know, they serve a purpose now, right? They serve a purpose now, and they want them to outbreed us now. But there will come a time when the automation is taking care of all of their needs, and they don't need people, you know, the little people anymore. And next thing you know, all of a sudden, like all the programs they ran to get white birth rates down, and you know, all the population control social engineering will kick in, and they'll make that population go down. In fact, even faster, I think.
Yeah, I think they would definitely have means to do that for sure. Okay, and John Selmer says, could Epstein be alive? I don't think so, and I don't think they need him to be alive. I mean, there's all this stuff about he's still alive, and they give him plastic surgery, and he's in Israel living the high life. Why? It Occam's razor is they killed him because he'd become a liability.
Right. So, there's no, yeah, there's no point to keeping him alive. I don't. Could he be? Who knows, right? We'll never know. We'll never know the official story. Bill Barr knows, I'm sure, but we'll never know the official story.
Yeah, exactly. And I want a comment, says, Bill Cooper was a legend. They killed him for it too.
Well, they did kill him because he predicted 9/11. People like are giving, like, even Tucker, I guess, when his interview with Alex Jones made a big deal out of, like, oh, look, Alex Jones predicted 9/11. How did he do that? He got it from Bill Cooper, who said it like a month before that, who name dropped Osama bin Laden like a month before that. And so it wasn't like something that Alex Jones just came up with. You know, there was a lot of people that were actually floating this theory that they were going to make some kind of big cataclysmic event, and they were going to blame Osama bin Laden, and then they were going to send a bunch of people to the Middle East or whatever. He was a legend, and he did understand a lot of stuff, but he also had like massive boomer race blind spots and hated white identity. He had an Asian wife, and he took it personally and was like, oh, you think my kids are mongrels, and, you know, and stuff like that. And ignored Jewish stuff and like would focus heavily on like the Masons instead and whatever. But yeah, for the time, I don't think he was a dishonest guy. However, useful to mention, just because I've mentioned it about everyone else, he also has an intelligence background. He was a Navy intelligence. So it's like, you know.
Fucking hell.
Yeah.
All right. And No Chance says, do you know a lot about the 1968 and Yom Kippur War? There's a new Golda Meir movie that could help with the Israelis as the victim narrative.
The who is the victim narrative?
Israelis.
Honestly, I don't know enough about that situation to give an intelligent response to that, I don't think. What about you? You got this?
Sorry. No chance. Neither of us can answer that. Maybe next time, says, a vocation doesn't give vacations. That's true. You do this for the love of it to some extent and the obligation. Okay, and I think, oh yeah, now the geezer clarified about John Grisham and A Time to Kill. He said it was Grisham that race swapped the characters. In reality, the victims, the Scott sisters, 12 and 16 respectively, were raped and beaten by a black guy in the early 80s. The novel was released in 89. So, yeah, I thought that was it, but my memory's vague. But yeah, it was John Grisham who race swapped it all.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
That no surprise they made so many movies out of his books then, huh?
Yeah, and that must have been one of the... I mean, the first time I was aware of him was The Firm, and I think that... I don't know, I can't remember which came first, but anyway, there we are. Skipville says, stay out of the pit. All right, and Shambolic says, Dev, whatever you do, not watch Bronx Tale. All right, whatever you do not watch Bronx Tale.
Trying the old reverse psychology, I see.
Very clever. And then there was one more on Telegram. Hey, Devin, you mentioned Ken Burns on your show recently. He is in Montana making shows about the buffalo and how white man bad. International Jews are using this front organization called the American Prairie Reserve to buy up generational ranches here. And Ken Burns is part of their propaganda campaign.
Well, you know, what's funny is by the way, that's a blood libel too. The whole white man came here and killed all the buffalo. The reality of it was the Native Americans, they didn't have horses. A lot of people don't realize that. They weren't like riding horses around until the white people showed up and left some horses. And then the horses, you know, there's wild horses now out, not where I live now, but like in places I've lived, there've been horses that just go around, and BLM actually, you know, not Black Lives Matter, but Bureau of Land Management goes and like and picks them up because they're supposedly bad for the environment or something. But the reason why there's so many of these horses out there is because, you know, the horses would get free, and the Native Americans figured out how to like start riding horses. And they're the ones that because they were able to ride horses, all of a sudden started using tactics like they would drive an entire herd of buffalo. Like, you know, like you see cowboys driving a herd of cattle to go from place to place, they would drive them off a cliff. They would drive an entire herd of buffalo off of a fucking cliff and then go to the bottom of the cliff and use, you know, to skin them all and whatever. And yeah, did white people show up while this was going on and kill more buffalo? Sure, but not nearly as many as the Native Americans did. The Native Americans were actually the ones that hunted a lot of these people into, or these animals into extinction. So that's just yet another Ken Burns blood libel.
Fucking hell. the amount of bullshit that is talked about us. It's infuriating, really. All right. I'm exhausted. I'm supposed to do a solo AMA after this. Because it's now halfway through. We're halfway through the main schedule of Millennial. So it was something I intended to do last year, but I didn't get around to doing it. So I'm going to do that. Is there anything else you'd like to bring up?
Not really. I mean, I think we covered a lot of stuff. Obviously, make sure you sub over on Odyssey and Rumble and follow me on Twitter and all in Telegram and all that good stuff. But yeah, I think we've covered pretty much everything.
The links should be very easy for people to find in the description of this video. At least on Odyssey. On Twitter, you can't do a description. It's rather annoying. So anyway, I'm sure people will be able to find you on there. Well, this has been great. So I've enjoyed it. It's very easy talking to you. It's not sort of stilted as it is with some people. You're very sort of laid back. All right. Well, yeah, I've enjoyed this, and I think the audience at home have as well. And hopefully our CIA handlers are also very performance. yeah, all right, excellent. Well, I'll be back in about 10 minutes for the solo AMA. And in the meantime, well, Devin Stack of Blackpilled, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Well, thanks for having me, and I'm sure I'll be here next year.
Do you want to do your signature sign-off thing where you say, for Blackpilled, I am...
Sure. For Blackpilled, I'm Devin Stack.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Bidding on this year's NFT ends on the 30th. It's your chance to own this one-of-a-kind commemorative piece, lovingly hand-coded by Millennial Woes himself. All aboard! Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.